You are listening to Radio Aryan.
Welcome to SS Britannia. Today's date is Monday, the 27th of March, 2017, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks. As always, I'm joined by the host of the Aryan Spring YouTube channel, Subar. Subar, how are you doing today?
Very well, thank you very much.
That's good to hear. It's full of the joys of spring here. It's we've passed the spring equinox. We've had lots of sunshine, and I'm told by the weather forecast that we're going to have a heat wave next week. We're going to have lovely weather to make up for all the terrible things that happened last week. Talking about the terrorist attack, there were dozens of people injured, policemen killed. Mm. I've talked about it a few times on the Daily Traditionalist and also on Truth Without Radio, so I don't want to go too much into it here, but I would like to get your take on it and your thoughts on it, Subal. So maybe we should start with that today.
I don't know. I mean, I just think we've reached the personally, I just wasn't very I didn't feel any great emotional reaction to it, really. I sat there and watched it on the TV and I was just like, oh yeah, that's what happens. The only time I really felt anything in my gut, like I really got angry, was when I found out that it was school children that had been hit by the car, little French school children. That peed me off. But apart from that, it's just business as usual, isn't it? We've basically entered a stage in Europe and in England where terrorism has now just become normalized, and it's just part of our daily existence, as Sadiq Khan has told us. You know, he's told us quite clearly. He said terrorism is part of being in a major city. Of course, if you go to Tokyo, which is the biggest city in the world, there's no terrorism there. But in a multicultural paradise like London, you have to take these kinds of acts of violence for granted, and it's part of our daily life. And it seems to me that the newspapers and the media in general are reacting in that way as well. It's just, I remember when we had the bomb on the bus and in the tube station, like, what was that? That was like 10 years ago, wasn't it? Or 12 years ago or something. I mean, I remember that was nonstop coverage on the news for 3 days running. It was just like wall to wall, just talking about it and talking about it. And obviously more people died, but still, it seems to me that this is blown up in the media and very quickly just settled down and just keep going with it. And that appears, that seems to me that is their tactic from now on. You know, back in the day when they planned 9/11, and probably when the whole, the London bombing happened as well, they were doing these terrorist acts to gear us up to go to war and to blow up Iraq, because Iraq is the enemy of Israel, right? And we are just the soldiers of Israel. So at that point in time, there was a lot of emphasis on, oh, the Muslims, let's go and blow them up. But now that we've blown up those countries and we've created, you know, we've made all the Muslims hate us, like really hate us more than they did already. And now that we have them pouring into our countries and the gates are open, and now that they're killing us on the streets, now the media doesn't want to put too much emphasis on these terrorist attacks anymore. I mean, that's the way it seems to me. I was just looking on the Daily Stormer today. I think it was somebody pulled a gun out in Paris. They shot some people. It's not even in the news. I remember a few weeks ago or a month ago, somebody drove another truck into somebody in Germany. It didn't even make the news. They pulled the guy out. They said, oh, it's a drunk driver. So it seems to me that the media's covering it up now. They don't want to emphasize it. And And it seems that people are just getting conditioned, and they're just getting used to it. And this is how it works. It's just attack upon attack upon attack upon attack, until at some point in the future, people are just going to be like, oh God, we just don't want to deal with it anymore. And then they'll just convert to Islam. That's the Islamic plan. So, yeah.
It does. It seems as if it's just routine now. They have a routine for when it happens, candlelit vigil, multi-faith leaders all get together, landmarks change color, people do things with their Facebook, a new hashtag is created, and then it just fades away. And I remember the same with 7/7. It was wall-to-wall coverage, and there were special programs that were on it at every couple of hours on all the channels. And back then, there was credible doubt whether this was some kind of false flag, because there was this need for war in Iraq and a need for a justification for going to war, and there were lots of questions about the people that were actually held to account for 7/7. The same with the Arabs that were held to account for 9/11. We know there was Jewish involvement in that. We know that there were people that were benefiting from that and had advance warning of it, Jews that had advance warning of it and did nothing to stop it. I believe it was 9/11 was Jews and Muslims together, mainly Jews pulling the strings in the background and Muslim fall guy. And at the time with 7/7, there was still sympathy for these Muslims. Could this be a false flag? Could this be innocent people that have been framed for this? But since then, the increase in these attacks and the increase in the violence against white people and the exposure of Islam and what's actually in the Quran and what it says about the white nations, finding out about the history of Islam trying to invade Europe, it becomes far more credible that these attacks are genuine. And I think all of these recent ones are genuine attacks, and the media itself, that's why the media is covering it up. That's why it wants to hide it, the same as it wants to hide black on white crime, and it doesn't tell us about that. And Khan, Mayor Khan, when he said that it's all part and parcel of living in a city, that's because that's what they want him to say. They want him to say that. They want people to think that this is just routine. Everywhere in the world is like this, and it's not all Muslims that are terrorists. And just before this attack happened, there was an ITN report on ex-members of National Action, the nationalist protest group that are no longer a protest group because they've been classified as terrorists. And yet people that are no longer a member of National Action that are just going out and being sociable, ITN did a news report on them trying to make out that this was something that needed to be stopped, and how dare these young people still have a political opinion when National Action were banned. And at the end of the article they were saying, and of course the one and only terrorist act in Britain was carried out by a white supremacist. And that's the narrative that they want to push. And when something like this happens, it shakes them up. They don't want that. They don't want people to remember that. They want to remember the death of Jo Cox. They want to remember that she was assassinated and it was a white supremacist who did this. Never mind the fact that there was nothing to actually prove that he was a white supremacist that did this. And just before that as well, they were saying that there's been a huge increase in the number of white nationalists that are being taken on by this PREVENT program, supposedly to prevent terrorism. That's because they're concentrating on going after white nationalists, and they're going after them for just sending tweets, criticizing the multicultural agenda, which has provided a climate where Muslims can attack white people like this. And that was just one Muslim last week, just one, that caused all that chaos and carnage. And when I saw it on the television, I just thought, here we go. I've been wondering when this was going to happen. And I felt the same as you. It really didn't bother me that much, because I've just become numb to it. We see so much of it now. Someone in the chat room said that they were punching things. It really got to them, and I almost envy him for not being so jaded and numb to the situation that I've become. It's like the people are there are other people that this has happened to. I don't live in the city. I live far away from the diversity. I'm as far away from it as I can possibly get. And that's the reason why, is because I don't want to be around these people. I want to be in a community where you don't have to be worried that someone's going to drive up the pavement and run you down and flatten you. And yet the people in London, they're all going to this vigil, these candlelit vigils. They're talking about unity and how we need more multiculturalism. You've got Theresa May saying that the Muslims are against multiculturalism, and that it was multiculturalism and democracy and these democratic values. That's why they attacked in London. But it's only because of multiculturalism and the democratic values giving Muslims a vote alongside the British citizens and the ethnic British people. That's the only reason why they were able to get into our country in the first place. So it seems to me that Theresa May is just repeating what her Jewish scriptwriters have told her to say, and it's got nothing to do with the real motives behind these Muslim attacks. It's just what the Jews want people to think is the motive behind these attacks. They want people to think that it's the diversity, it's the fact that London is full of all these different races, and apparently they get on, according to the media. We know that they don't, but they seem to want us to think that that's what ISIS are against. So if we want to be against ISIS and against Islamic fundamentalism, we have to be super friendly to all Muslims, the very people that are actually doing this to us. It must cause a lot of confusion in people's minds, I think, a lot of neuroses, because they're being told two different things at the same time, something opposite of what they're actually seeing.
Yeah, it reminds me of the infamous Trudeau quote, isn't it? If they kill you, if they kill you, you win, or whatever. If they use violence, you win, or something stupid like that. It's like, all right, mate, yeah.
Or just let them kill us. If you defend yourself, they win. If you defend yourself against them, they win. That is exactly what they're saying.
Yeah. Man. Yeah. No, it's crazy. No, it's definitely not false flags. I mean, I've just got a lot of conspiracy theory on my mind this week in particular, because I've been dredging through a lot of the old conspiracy theory type movies that I used to watch 10 years ago when I was into the whole 9/11 truth movement. And so I've been, you know, flicking through the YouTube, looking at these different conspiracy type producers. And it's amazing that there's still some of them out there still calling this kind of thing a false flag activity and talking about crisis actors and things like this. I mean, even for the recent one in London, there was some conspiracy guy and he was saying, oh, it's fake. And he had a photo of the knife and he was like, there's no blood on the knife. And and I'm watching this guy's video. It's got like 300,000 views, you know? And I don't know. Don't know how stupid. And then yeah, I was flicking through all the videos on his channel, and then you can see it as well, he's anti-Trump as well. And it just, I have a lot of sympathy with conspiracy theory in general. I think there are a lot of valid points that they make, especially stuff that isn't even really that conspiratorial, like fluoride in our water. I don't think it's healthy. Genetically modified food, I don't think it's healthy at all. There's a lot of stuff which is, They raise a lot of valid points, but they get into such this crazy mindset. They think that with this tinfoil hat mindset, and they get so detached from reality, they can't even see that somebody like Donald Trump is a good thing for us. And they can't even see it when Muslims are killing them on the street. It's like a cult or something. It's just some weird, unhealthy mentality. I mean, I'm hoping that people are breaking out of it. I think a lot of it, it's definitely Jewish misinformation as well. I mean, you can start looking at these videos, it's just like some of the stuff that they say, you can just get utterly lost in it, and you don't know, you end up not knowing you know, whether you're coming or going. But it's just, well, I mean, what really strikes me is that all of these conspiracy theorists, they like to talk about Kennedy and say how great Kennedy was because he signed this document 1001 or whatever it was to allow you know, America to print its own currency to kill the bank, so to speak. And they all say, oh, Kennedy, he was the last real president. But you've got like a Trump phenomena happening right in front of your face, and they're too blind, stupid to see it. So anyway, just frustrated with that.
Well, I was just thinking then when you mentioned about the conspiracy documentaries, I was just wondering whether you spotted Jews, a lot of Jews in there that you hadn't before, Jewish producers or Jewish people that were involved in these actions against us, but they weren't actually being identified as Jews. They would always identify them as something else.
No, I didn't check. I mean, but as you raised the question, I will say that Loose Change was done by a Jew. I know that now. And that was one of the big 9/11 truth movies. And the other one, Zeitgeist, or have you said that stupid
Zeitgeist
word.
Yeah, that one again.
That was done by a Jew too.
Yeah.
They're both Jews.
And I think this reaction that people have against this, when they find out that they've been lied to and they find out that the media has been lying to them, instead of being more critical of what they receive, but not throwing everything out, not throwing the baby out with the bathwater, they seem to lose all their critical faculties and say, right, every single thing that the media tells us is a lie. And then they'll believe that last week's attack must be a false flag. They'll believe that it all must be crisis actors. It's like there are three ways of looking at things. You can either believe everything that you're told, you can take everything that you're told with a pinch of salt, or you can not believe everything that you're told. And I think some of these people go too far towards not believing anything at all. And that's that can be a problem, because we rely on what the media tells us to produce our own propaganda, to be able to analyze it. And if you discredit it entirely, then we haven't got anything that we can use to propagandize to our own people. If you're discrediting the raw data, the raw material, then we haven't got anything, because we haven't got our own news companies that are going out there and reporting on this at the time. We haven't got access to the forensic reports and the police and everything else that the main news agencies have actually got. So if we discredit the primary news sources, we actually end up disarming ourselves, because we haven't got anything that we can analyze or use to prove our point. Like when we're trying to say, well, Muslims are attacking white people and they're a threat to white people, if people are saying, oh, well, it's all crisis actors, then that disarms that threat, doesn't it?
I personally think that we should bring these people over. When I go back on the YouTube, and I'm going to do it at some point, I want to make a whole bunch of kind of like conspiracy theory videos, and but putting the Jew at the middle of it. I got to say, I mean, I've been red-pilled now probably 2 years now. Your friend Mike Wise, he did that video, The Greatest Story Never Told.
Dennis Wise.
That's the one that red-pilled me.
Yeah, Dennis Wise.
Dennis Wise, sorry. And then I watched David Duke, and then I was like, oh my God. I remember very clearly going into my friend's room, and I was like, it's like staring into the face of evil. I remember saying it to him. I was like totally shocked for like a month. I was like, yeah, it's because I've been into conspiracy theory for years. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, right, that's what's going on. Now I get it, you know. But one of the things which struck me the most watching David Duke's videos is like, I was just thinking, well, why doesn't this guy ever talk about the banking institutions? And why doesn't this guy ever talk about 9/11 and the truth movement? I mean, if he had done videos about that, maybe I would have come to that realization sooner. So I don't think it's something that everybody has to do. I mean, you've got different white nationalists doing different things. I mean, you've got people like, you know, Richard Spencer and Millennial Woes, who don't seem to talk about Jews at all. And then you've got, you know, hardcore people like Andrew Anglin. I think there's also room for some white nationalists maybe to talk about some of these kooky conspiracy theories and bring those people over to our side. That's what I want to do. I've been saying I want to do it for ages. I haven't done it. But and I mean, I also got to point out, I said this, we've talked about this before, but I have a friend in Canada, and she was looking after an old lady. And this old lady got cancer, and she's a bit of a hippie, and she didn't like the chemotherapy. So she went to an alternative doctor, and he used a machine. It's called the Rife machine, and it's invented by a guy called Royal Rife back in the 1930s. And this technology was suppressed. And I brought the book. There's a book. It's by a guy called Barry Leans. It's called The Cancer Cure That Worked. It was suppressed by the American Medical Association. And not directly. It was suppressed by a Jew called Fishbein. I forget his name. Something Fishbein. But I looked him up. He's a Jew. And he ran the journal for the American Medical Association. And obviously he was making a lot of money for advertising for different drugs and things like this. So they suppressed this cure. But it cured my friend of cancer. And I got to say, I'm not a doctor. I'm not an engineer. But I know that the Jews run the pharmaceutical companies. I know they make a lot of money out of that. And I know they sure as hell don't want people curing cancer with a simple machine that you can, you know, hook yourself up to and cure yourself. And I know it cured my my friend's, this lady that my friend knows in I've 4 months,
I've,
boom,
I've heard it
cured.
Advertised. But I mean, I've heard it advertised on Rincey. I've heard it advertised for on Rincey, these machines on the right. Rincey Radio Network, Royal Raymond just, Rife or something.
Royal Rife, yeah. But just to illustrate this point, so I know not personally, but like friend of a friend, I know about 4 or 5 people that have got cancer. Some of it's quite serious. Some of these people, the doctors have given up on them and they just said, yeah, you got a month to live and you'll be dead. Right. And I'm telling these people, my friend cured herself with cancer. You're in Canada using this machine. And I'm honest. I'm like, look, I'm not a doctor. I'm not an engineer. I don't know how it worked, but I know it worked. Right. And I'm telling these people. And I tell them the name of the machine. I write it down. I give it to them. I say, you know, you could research it. You can. This is the machine that you brought. I think it cost about $200 for this machine. It's called Spooky 2. I don't know why they gave it a stupid name, but they did. And, I'm telling these people. And you know what? None of them bothered to spend 5 minutes of their time Googling it and just reading about it. None of them. None of them. And it, for me, it's a new... it's a new realization about human nature, because I can understand why people don't want to get involved in politics, because obviously it's very confusing unless you understand the Jewish problem. If you read in the newspapers, it must be very bewildered. I mean, I remember being bewildered for years. It's like, what the hell is going on? You know, why are these people in the government so stupid? Da, 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 da. I can understand you just switch off, right? Because you think, well, I can't do anything about it. Doesn't make sense. You switch it off. So I can understand people being apathetic about politics, but you would think that when you're facing death and when doctors have given up on you and just told you that you're going to die and they've just left you to die, you would think that at that moment, your survival mechanism would kick in and you would start reading about stuff on the internet looking for a cure. But lo and behold, even with me pushing them on and telling them my friend cured herself in this machine, they don't do it. So my conclusion is, and I know why they don't do it. They don't do it because the red pill is too bitter to swallow. Because if they find out that there's a cure for cancer, what does it mean? It means the government's lying to them. The doctors are lying to them. The medical establishment is lying to them. And it's, they know it. People know it deep down. It's like, oh my God, it's like the government's against me. The establishment, it's a conspiracy. I mean, they know it. Deep down, and they don't want to take that red pill. It's too much of a bitter taste, and they would rather die. They would literally rather die than face the fact that the establishment doesn't care about them. And so because of that, I think that although a lot of these conspiracy theorists, they're a bit tinfoil hat, and they're a bit crazy and they're a bit stupid for not accepting Trump. At least they understand, at least they are critical of the government. And because they've crossed that block, if you see what I mean, that giant psychological block, perhaps we can bring them in to our movement.
Well, we need to get them to cross that that other block, because even though you've got the truth movement and they're looking into all these conspiracies, a lot of them are still very, very frightened of being called racist. They'll do everything they can not to be called racist or anti-Semitic, calling them Zionists or lizards or globalists, oligarchs, bankers, all these different words they've got for them because they don't want to be called racist. And criticizing blacks for their low IQ and their high crime rate, they're very, very worried about doing that. So they might be brave enough to talk about the way that the government has not got our best interests at hand. The government's been taken over by forces that are hostile to us, but they don't have the courage to go the whole way and point out the ethnic component in it. And I think one of the symptoms of this, and you mentioned about JFK and the banking, and I think that is a good example of it, because a lot of the truth movement is talking about the banks and the usury system and the way that the money is just printed, and it doesn't actually represent anything. It's just numbers on a piece of paper. And they'll talk about JFK and how he was courageous in taking on the banks, and they'll come out with all these alternative systems saying that we should be using this, but none of them will entertain the fact that Adolf Hitler fought against the banks and set up a system of creating Germany's own money and funded the German economy and the German economic miracle that came about through him kicking out the internationalist bankers and setting up his own banking system that wasn't based upon usury. And the conspiracy type people, the truther type people, most of them are not aware of that at all. And if you try and suggest that to them, it's anathema to them. It's really shocking to them. So maybe that would be a good point that we could use to wake them up to this. So wake them up to National Socialism and wake them up to race. Maybe that's a way to bring them into it, is to highlight Adolf Hitler's war against the banks, really, and the system that he came up with. I think the first book that exposed all of this, I think it's called The Abolition of the Slavery to Usury Interest, something like that. It was written in about 1920. There is a copy of it in English that's available, and it talks about how you have two different types of money. You have money that comes from interest on loans, and you have money that actually represents capital and real investment. And it exposed the Rothschilds and how they'd made all this money from usury. It wasn't from being industrious, it wasn't from investing in industry, it was from buying and selling and putting interest on top. And that's the bit that is missing from Marxism. If you look at Marxism, when it talks about banking and the bankers, it's all about how these guys have got so much more money than the poor man, and they don't deserve it. They don't deserve to have all this money, so we should take some of it back. It doesn't expose the usury system in any way, shape or form. He avoids that. And that's the bit that the Marxists and the left and the communists, that's the bit that they're missing, is usury. And the conspiracy crowd have got that. They understand that usury cannot be a part of an equitable banking system. So we just need to show them that Hitler was the one that fought against that. He wasn't the bad guy that he's made out to be.
Yeah, I do agree. I mean, especially when it's so obvious that the Jews made the banking system. I mean, it's like the most obvious thing in the world. I really don't understand why the alt-right and white nationalists in general don't talk about it more, but because it was one of Hitler's main platforms. So I mean, I can understand for propaganda reasons, you might not want to talk about chemtrails or fluoride or 9/11 was a demolition job or kooky kind of conspiracy theories like that, because they're kind of hard to prove and they seem a bit weird and they seem a bit strange. But everybody hates the banks. Everybody. You go on the street and ask anybody what they think about the banking system, they'll tell you they flipping hate it. I mean, everybody. And it's everybody knows that the Jews did it as well. I mean, it's just like an unavoidable historical fact. Christians were against usury, and that's how the Jews got their power and their position in medieval European society. It's by lending money to the kings. So it seems to me to be this issue which we should embrace. And I would really like to see a movement basically to, you know, clear the debt. And what I think what the debt in England is $1.5 trillion, clear the debt and create let the government print its own money. And I will say on this point, it is a bit of a thorny issue, because I do believe that really when it gets in reality, gold is the real money because it has intrinsic value. So there are a lot of arguments to talk about bringing back gold coins and things like that. But it's also been historically proven that a government created fiscal economy is fine. I mean, I think it's the example is given is Guernsey. I think it's Guernsey. They have a they print their own money. The government in Guernsey, the little, you know, it's only a little island, but they have their own government. They print their own money. They've been doing it for years. That's why that place is so rich. And they print a certain limited number of notes or coins, and then that's it. That's how they run their currency. They don't have a gold. It's not a gold standard. So I think ultimately gold is the real money. But if it's a government owned fiscal currency, it works fine. And I think it's an issue we should embrace. I think we'd get a lot more people into our movement if we did embrace it.
I think the problem with gold is that there's a finite amount of gold. There's only a certain amount of gold, and it has to be dug up out of the ground, and it has to be refined, and there's a hell of a lot of work goes into producing that lump of gold, and then it can be used as a token for the value of something else, because that's what all money is. It's a token for a value. It's like a measure. If you have a tape measure and you're measuring size, money is just a way to measure the value of a product or whatever it's worth. You can add it up in money, in currency form, and then you can say what the value of something is. So you don't necessarily have to have something that's cost a lot of resources and a lot of work in order to represent that value. That's what the fiat currency is. It's a promise to pay back a certain amount. So the value that's inherent in that is your promise. That's what really has the value, is your word. And that's why it's called fiat, because it's created by word. It's the same as the world, according to the Christian Bible, was created by the word. That's what fiat is. So your word has a hell of a lot of value. The whole banking system is based on your word. But because we've got Jews that are involved in it, it's become separated from that. And they've worked out that they don't actually have to have the exact amount of people giving their word to create the money. They can just create as much of it as they like. That's what this quantitative easing was. So there's no the government don't seem to have a problem with creating money that's not actually backed by anyone's promises or value of the work that they're going to do, their sweat equity. They don't have any problem in doing that if it's to bail out these Jewish bankers. But if they're going to be actually doing that correctly, based upon the value of the products and the work that the British nation could do, they're not interested in doing that. They would rather have this Jewish system, which goes back to William of Orange giving giving free rein basically to the Jews, giving them the right to run the Bank of England. And it goes back to there, and the system comes from there, and that's where the fractional reserve banking came from, where they said, well, if you've got £100 worth of gold in the vault, then you can loan out 10 times that amount, because you're not going to get 10 times that amount of people asking for their money back all at once. You're only likely to only get 1/10 of that asking for their money back at once. So that's where this fractional reserve system came in, and that's why gold wouldn't be so good, because if you only had £100 worth of gold and you lent out that £100 worth of gold, you'd have to go out and do loads more work to and find some more gold before you could lend out any more and before any new building projects could start. So that's why a gold-backed system isn't so good. And this was the thing that Hitler did. He came up with something different to the Reichsmark. I think it was based on labor. I can't recall the exact name of it, like a labor exchange note or something like that. And what they would do is they would lend out the amount that was needed for the building project, and they work out the amount that the building project would make. And once the building project was finished, they would then get all the money back from that, and then that would zero the debt. And that's the way that a banking system should work. It should be exact and mathematical. So a certain amount of money is advanced for the project to be completed, and that certain amount that is advanced is the exact amount that the project is going to make once it's finished to come back. And then it's zeroed. But with the banking system that we've got at the moment, the Jews, you say to the Jew, I want to borrow £100. The Jew writes out £100, and then that you have to work to pay that £100 back. The Jew hasn't lent you anything, and on top of that, he puts interest, which again, he's done nothing to earn that interest. That interest isn't going to come from whatever it is that you've made, because you borrowed £100. It's for £100 project. You're going to make £100 back, and yet the Jew wants £25 back interest. So where's that interest going to come from? The only possible place that interest can come from is if somebody else takes out another loan on top. So then the economy blows up, and it keeps inflating and inflating and inflating until you get to the situation where we are at now, where it has to rely upon more and more people taking out more and more loans just to pay back the interest on the previous ones. And we only just finished up paying off some of our loans that we had from the war. This system that we have they must have known that it was going to fall apart, that it was going to get to a certain stage where the whole banking system was going to crash, because you can't just keep expanding like that all the time. You want to have a system that's stable, that doesn't have inflation, that doesn't have deflation. And why should you have inflation? Why should it be that somebody that bought a house 50 years ago for half a year's wages, and the value of that house now makes them a millionaire? Why should it be like that? There's no reason for it to be like that. If you had a stable economy and a stable currency, then the more wealth that the nation could create, the more wealth the nation would have. Whereas at the moment, the more wealth a nation creates, the more money the bankers can siphon off from it for themselves.
Yeah, the whole housing scam is just that's a whole nother story in itself. It's like, so I think it was George Orsman, he commented on it. He said the British, they want cheap housing, and at the same time, they want the value of that house to go up. You can't do both. But I think a lot of the people in the House of Lords, they make a lot of money out of the housing bubble. I mean, basically, the people that are already in the housing market, they make a lot of money out of it. And the people that aren't in the housing market, they just get screwed. But I mean, as you say, it's another story in itself, and it wouldn't even be happening. That kind of bubble wouldn't even be happening if it wasn't for the fiat currency. And I think actually the first real bubble recording in history was the tulip bubble, which was in Holland, the Jewish owned Holland. And that's really the origin of all capitalism. What you had is Isabel and Ferdinand kicked the Jews out of Spain, and then they got kicked out of Portugal as well. Some of them went to the Ottoman Empire, some of them went to Italy, but a lot of them went to Spanish owned Holland. And then they started a revolution, and they took the northern part of that country, and the Spanish couldn't reconquer it because, I mean, a lot of the land is reclaimed from the sea, isn't it? So it's lower than sea level. So they just flood the um, flood the fields, you know, so the army can't, so they won it, right? So they got the northern part of that country, and it was a so-called golden age of the Dutch Republic. And that is the birthplace of capitalism. And they were able to do it because of the Protestant Revolution. They were able to do it because Calvin, John Calvin, said that usury was okay. So a lot of people say John Calvin is the father of capitalism. He was obviously part of the Protestant Reformation. Martin Luther didn't actually want to create a whole new religion. Martin Luther wanted to reform the church, but John Calvin, he just turned against the church altogether and started smashing, you know, idols of the Madonna and this and that. He formed a completely new radical Protestant religion, which said that usury was okay. And then a lot of him and his followers, they went to, a lot of the Calvinites, they went to Dutch Holland, and they mixed all the Jews there, and that's the birthplace of capitalism. And then from there, they started interfering in England, because of course at that time the Jews weren't allowed in England, because Longshanks kicked them out in 1290. The Jews weren't allowed in England, but they started making political disturbances, because the Dutch, they had a big naval empire. And like I said, the Dutch East India Company was established in 1601. There was that, oh, I talked about him last week, something Cohen, and he was just killing and murdering people in Indonesia. I mean, he was a Christian, but he was a, you know, Jewish blood, obviously Cohen in it. They had a huge naval empire, but they didn't, it's a small country, so they didn't have the whack to back it up. So the Jews, they wanted England. And that's why they started, you know, that's why they agitated. A lot of the Jews that had so-called converted to Christianity, they came over to London, they became moneylenders, started creating agitation between Catholics and Protestants, started the English Civil War, and then they write a letter to Cromwell and say, oh, can you let us back in? And Cromwell's like, yeah, all right. And then, you know, a couple of decades later, the Bank of England is established, and we've been in their hands ever since. But I've been reading this book, History of Central Banking and the Enslavement of Mankind, by Stephen Mitford Goodson. It's a great book, really recommend it. But he talks about the glorious Middle Ages, and he says that basically after they kicked the Jews out, what they started doing is they started using these tally sticks. And I've seen this in that famous documentary, what's it called? The Money Masters? That's, I don't know if you've seen that.
Yeah, with the tally sticks.
Yeah, the tally stick. So it's basically a piece of wood, and you kind of cut it in half, and you obviously can't fake a piece of wood. And I'm not really sure how to exactly explain how they work, but it's a good way of kind of keeping track of debts and stuff that stops you from cheating and starting this kind of fractional reserve banking thing. And that was used throughout the Middle Ages, and this until Henry VIII, I think. Henry VIII was just a complete bastard, sorry, but I'm just not a big fan of Henry VIII. Henry VIII started relaxing the laws on usury. So this guy just destroyed all the monasteries, killed a lot of the monks, stole all their wealth, killed some of his wives, and then he relaxed the laws on usury. But until Henry VIII, he's making the point, it was a golden age of wealth in this country. And he was saying that this is the period of history in this country when we didn't have any usury. This is the period of history when we had all these great Gothic cathedrals being built, and the people were able to build them. Why? Because they had so much free time. He said they would work for like 200 days a year or less. I mean, they had 100 different, he was pointing out in the Christian calendar, there were like 100 different festivals, the religious festivals that they had to follow through the year. So they held this free time, and they had wealth, and in their spare time, they would help to build these giant, you know, Gothic cathedrals, and everybody was rich and everybody was happy. And you know, then Henry VIII, he relaxed the laws on usury, and then Elizabeth, you know, started inviting the so-called, you know, converted Christian Jews back in to be moneylenders, and then the whole Civil War started. And, you know, down we went. I've also been reading E. Michael Jones. He has an interesting take on it. And he says that, the British were basically just fighting against the Catholics. It was just a war against Catholicism because, you know, and this, our great hero, Nicholas Drake. I mean, he was just a pirate that would just steal these, you know, the gold from Spain and this and that. So it's a whole different perspective on history. Yeah.
Well, I think the period you're talking about was Merry England, wasn't it? I wonder if these tally sticks, whether that might have had anything to do with the Great Fire of London. All the debts would have disappeared, wouldn't they? You set fire to all the tally sticks. I wonder if there was a connection there. And the Jews were funding and helping Bibles to be produced because these Bibles were very inaccurate. That's one of the reasons why the Catholics didn't want Bibles to be translated into English and printed up, because you would get inaccurate translations. And the Jews were funding a lot of this. And there was a lot of intrigue, and they were helping out these Protestants and encouraging them to fight against the Catholics. So that's what E. Michael Jones shows, I think. But it wasn't just the Protestants that relax the laws on usury. It started off with the Pope and the Monte de Pieta, and the Monte de Pieta was the Bank of Charity, and it was supposed to be they actually had a proper one in Britain, and it was a bank that was just funded with money from rich people that wanted to help out the poor, and they just put the money in there, and if people wanted to borrow money, they could borrow it and then they could pay it back, but there was no interest put on it. And eventually it ran out of money and it stopped. But the Monte di Pietà, which was in Italy, that the Pope set up, they were allowed to put interest on it. And eventually it became almost like a tax on the poor. And all this money from this interest was paying for the wars as well. So the Pope started changing the actual meaning of the word usury itself, because it was always anything extra on top of the principle that you asked for back, anything. It didn't matter if it was only 1%, 2%, 3%, anything extra on top of the principle was usury. And the popes changed the meaning of that. They said that usury is only if it's biting, only if it's a certain amount of interest. And then they started making these laws against usury, saying that you could not charge more than 10% interest. And that would be their law against usury. And up until that point, usury had been seen as a mortal sin. It was the same as murder. It was that bad that it was seen as, because it was stealing from your fellow man. It was stealing from the community. It was taking advantage of somebody else being worse off than you. It meant that you didn't take any risk in any business venture, because it had been agreed that the person you lent the money to was going to pay you this extra bit back. If the ship crashed or ran ashore and all the cargo was destroyed, the person that had borrowed the money still had to pay it back. Whereas before then, if somebody wanted to lend some money, they had to become a part of the venture itself. And there were strict laws about what percentage of the profits they could have. But if the cargo was destroyed or it didn't make any profit, the person that had borrowed the money, as it were, they didn't have to pay it back. The person that had lent the money shared in the misfortune. It was basically a way of making certain that nobody could get rich just from money itself. You can only get rich from putting hard work in and industriousness. And once the Jews took over the banking system and they were allowed to add usury to it, the system quickly became based around usury, and money was suddenly able to make money. And if you look in the Old Testament, where you first read about usury being outlawed, it makes it clear that it's a weapon of war. It's only to be used on your enemies, never supposed to be used on your own people. And yet here we have our entire economy and banking system is based around this, is based around taking advantage of the poor. Whereas really it should be based around doing what's best for the nation. helping the nation out. If you help, if you have a closed nation and a closed economy, if you help the poor out, then the poor are going to get more wealthy, and then they can help the next generation of poor out, and the money stays within that closed system. It can't get siphoned off. But if you have a foreign group within that system, they can siphon the money off and take it to somewhere else. Because there's another verse in the Bible, it says, cast your bread upon the shore, because it will come back to you. Because if you cast it out to sea, it's going to come back. Meaning, if you hand out the money to people within your community that are worse off, they're going to be, that's going to help them out. And eventually you'll get that money back, because it's got nowhere else that it can go. But as soon as you allow other races in, they can then take the wealth of the nation, and they can take it out of the nation and use it to just increase their own well-being rather than contributing to the community. And the human rights law as well, I mean, that originally goes back to it being your human right to make as much profit as you possibly can from your fellow man, which is really twisted. Again, it's taking advantage of people that don't have as much as you. And at the same time, you also had the just price. Things that were in demand had to be subsidized so that everybody could afford them. If there was a disaster happened and you needed lots of bricks and building material, they would subsidize the bricks and building materials so that everybody could rebuild. Whereas what they would do now is, if there was a disaster and there was a shortage of building materials, they will put the price up on them to make as much profit as they can. But this making as much profit as you can, it's a totally alien way of looking at things, because that means taking advantage of somebody within your community. It always has to be somebody that's going to pay. And if you're looking at the nation as a whole rather than looking at the individuals, then why would you want to do that? It's not going to be any good for the nation, is it?
Yeah, I'm not against, I'm not a communist, I'm not against rich people, and I'm not against the merchant class. And I mean, as you know, I believe in Varnashram Dharma. So I believe that there's an intellectual class, and then a warrior class, and then a merchant class, and then a working class at the bottom. And the duty of the intellectual class is to speak the truth. The duty of the warrior class is to uphold justice. And the duty of the merchant class is to create wealth. And it, you know, it's said in the Vedas that merchants are supposed to be greedy. You're supposed to have this kind of, you know, money-minded attitude where you want more wealth, you want more gold, more cows, more this, more that. But so it's not, the inclination to make money is not bad in itself, because if you don't have a strong merchant class, then you know your country's going to be poor, right? You're just kind of a communist class, like we're seeing in today. Our merchant class is collapsing. Everyone's just a worker, right? Everyone just wants to work a wage. They don't want to build great businesses anymore. But so I'm not against the inclination itself to make money. Greed in itself is not a bad thing. I know a few people that are quite greedy, but they've accumulated, you know, huge amounts of wealth, and then they're generous as well. You see, this is the thing. Some of the people that I know that are very wealthy are also very generous. And the two things are supposed to go hand in hand. And this is really well understood in Vedic culture, that if you give charity, you will become wealthy. You the more money you give away, the more money comes back to you. And it's considered to be, well, it's considered to be divine, to be perfectly honest. It's, you know, God is watching. He rewards those people who are charitable and who give charity at the right the right time. So it's not that the desire to accumulate wealth is bad in itself. It's just twisted. It's twisted into a profit, and it's twisted into something which is just parasitical. It's just, and what the Jews have done is they've created, you know, before it used to be just the Jews doing this, but now everybody does it. They've created an entire race of internationalists who, you know, everybody knows if you win the lottery, right? If you make any money, you want to stash a bit of cash here, stash a bit there, maybe stash some in a, in a tax haven. Three of them are owned by us, by the way, the Virgin Islands, the Cayman Islands, and the other one. They're owned by us. I always find it absolutely hilarious when you see this come up in the newspaper, like The Guardian, usually banging on about the evil tax havens. And I think, well, that we own them. It's stupid. But there's a whole class of internationalists now. Everybody does it. Everybody's rootless. That everybody just moves their money around from one country to another country. I was watching a documentary about the super rich, the 1%, and they were showing some of the houses that they live in, and the people were just commenting and saying that these people, they buy these houses not as a home to live in, but just as an investment. It's basically considered to be a place to park your money. That's what all of London is now. That people people are talking about some of these really rich areas in London, and they complain that some of the local pubs, they just got to close down because nobody goes to them there anymore because nobody lives there. They just buy houses and hope, as a way, as an investment, hope that the value of the house is going to go up so they can sell it off later on or whatever. It's international finance, and it's awful, and everybody hates it. And I think we should destroy the Bank of England, and we should just print our own money. And I think that really should be part of our nationalist policies. I mean, I think it's something people could really get on board with. And there you go.
Yeah, so the means to prosperity have become an end in themselves. And what you're talking about there with the merchants increasing their wealth, well, the merchants would then spend that wealth. And this is the noblesse oblige. The money classes were obliged to help those out that were not so well off as they were. And it was seen that that was the reason why they were well off in the first place. They'd been blessed by God to have more money than the others. And the reason for that was so that they could then help the others. And if the others were industrious and they'd received that help, then they would increase in wealth, and then they would go on to do the same to somebody else that was less well off. And in that way, that wealth and prosperity would pass around the whole community. Whereas now, that wealth and prosperity, you're encouraged to keep that all to yourself. And that wealth and prosperity goes on paying interest and paying usury back. My unearned money that hasn't come from doing any hard graft or any work. It's just come from having money in the first place. So what should be the means to greater prosperity has become an end in itself, and it's used to suck the wealth from the nation instead of creating the wealth for the nation. And it's all come about from allowing these Jews in. When I was saying about the Pope and these Monte de Pietas, the only reason why they had to set these Monte de Pietas up in the first place is because they had Jews there that were charging these high interest rates. And instead of saying, well, we need to ban Jews because usury is banned, it's against Christian law, so we need to ban either these Jews stop loaning interest or we kick the Jews out. Instead of saying that, they said, well, we'll have to set up our own parallel money lenders lending to the poor at lesser rate of interest. And what they should have really done is said, well, no, we can't lend it interest. Charity is charity. You can't say, I'm going to help you out, but you have to pay me a little bit extra back. That's not charity. This is another thing that really gets me is what people think is charity nowadays, which is basically businesses that are there to make money and to take money from people to give them the illusion that they've helped somebody else out, when in actual fact, all they've done is contributed to a business. They're not actually helping people out. Far better to help out an individual that you see that needs help rather than give money to any of these approved governmental charities, because they're just businesses, and they just increase the poverty rather than helping the poverty. Far better to help people out, and then you've actually engaged in charity in itself. All these meanings of these words have changed over the years to mean something quite different from what they originally meant. But we're starting to get to the end of the podcast now, and it's pretty good that we've been talking about money and banks all the way through, because we would like to remind people to donate to Morgoth's Review, and also you can donate to Radio Aryan as well. If you've got Bitcoin, we've got a Bitcoin wallet, and the identifying number for that is at the bottom of every article. We do have overheads, we do have costs, so if you can contribute, it's much appreciated. If you can't contribute, we still much appreciate your support, and we like to read your comments, and we like to read your encouragement, and we also feel very blessed and very honored that we're in a position that we can talk to you all in the way that we do. Subal, have you got anything you'd like to add here at the end before we finish?
Yeah, I think, yeah, donate to Morgoth's Review. I think we're going to keep saying it at the end of every podcast now. It's like a mantra. It's propaganda. But I think it should be done. And I really think, yeah, white nationalism in general and the alt-right in general needs a bit of tough love, a bit of, you know, people need to get a kick up the ass and just tell them to donate. And I'm the same as well. I'm lazy. I didn't donate for, well, I was going to donate to the Daily Storm, but I couldn't figure out Bitcoin. But I mean, it took me a long time to get the money out of my pocket. And if people were more pushy about it and more, you know, pushy for the money, I think people would donate more quickly. I mean, I will say I lived in Brazil for some time, and in Brazil, when I was there, I saw this. There's a massive Christian movement, the evangelical movement. I don't really think it was good. I prefer Catholicism. But anyway, the reason this movement was so successful, or one of the reasons, is that they demanded that the congregation give 10% of their wages. And so it self-funded itself through just poor people. I mean, it was basically mostly poor people that were involved in this movement, and it just grew and grew and grew and grew. And that's what you need to do. If you've got a movement and you want it to grow, you have to pay for it. So if you're sitting at home and you're upset about the terrorist attacks, and you're upset about the Pakistani gang rapes, and you want to do something about it, £10 a month. If you get 200 people to give £10 a month to Morgoth's Review, he can go full time. And you know, if I reckon 100 people, £10 a month, £12,000 a year, I reckon you can go and live in Eastern Europe for that. That's what I'd like to do, maybe at some point when I get my act together. But yeah, dish the cash. There you go.
If you just think that you're paying out money all the time for things, and that's all going back into the Jewish banking system, but if you're donating to nationalists, you know that that's gone on a really good cause. It's gone on, it's gone to people like yourself that are doing what we can for white people. It's a positive thing to do, and you feel good that you've donated as well, that you've directly helped out with preventing white genocide and waking white people up, and generally increasing virtue of our people, which is what it's all about, really, I think, is trying to increase the virtue of the white race, because we're a pretty unvirtuous lot at the moment. Present company accepted.
Sorry to interrupt, but generosity is a virtue. And I got to say, the Muslims are generous. They give money to the imams. Even the Jews are generous. I mean, I know they got a lot of money, but they give money to the rabbis. It's part of their religion. If we've lost our religion, and if we're not generous, if we don't give, then we're going to be destroyed.
Well, I have faith that we're not going to be destroyed, and I have faith in our people, and I have faith that the movement's going to continue to grow as it is right now. So thank you very much for coming on, Subal. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We won't be back next week, actually. We've got something else for you next week, but we will be back the week after. So tune in then to find out what it is, and tune in the week after for more SS Britannia. We hope you have a wonderful week ahead of you.
To the anti-white system on RadioAryan.com.